Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Parenting is Easy podcast, where we will discuss the pleasures and the frustrations, the good and the bad, and the rewarding and the troubling aspects of parenting. I am your host, Hananya Abraham, and I'm a psychotherapist that specializes in working with teenagers, young adults, and parents with a specific niche in assisting with communication within the family dynamics. While everyone has their own unique journey and experiences as a parent and as a child, there are many common affiliations and attributes that we can all relate to and share. Together, we will learn from personal stories and experiences from parents across many different backgrounds, cultures, and communities. So get comfortable, grab your glass of coffee, and let's get right into the interview. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Parenting is Easy, said no one ever. I'm your host, Hananya Abraham. And today I am joined by a master educator, Tim McCarthy. Tim holds a master's degree in education and a grandmaster's rank in martial arts. He has combined his years of experience as a classroom teacher and administrator in both the private and the public school settings, with even more years of experience teaching and developing martial arts programs to create a simple plan for the education of our children. His unique perspective, combining Eastern and Western educational philosophy, creates a powerful roadmap for raising balanced children in an increasingly unbalanced world. He has been a host and speaker at the international conventions and has appeared on hundreds of webinars and podcasts. Without further ado, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm excited to be here and talk to your audience of parents.
Okay, so I want to start, you know, with one of the things that stood out for me when you and I were connecting is four-dimensional parenting. Can you explain to the listeners here what that is and how we would go about trying to implement that at home?
All right, so it started with basically online and the kids online. And in my opinion, the kids are living more and more in a two-dimensional world, as we all are. Two-dimensional world being length and width. Your tablet, your phone, your TV, and your computer are all two-dimensional objects. They have length and width, but no depth. All right, so the real world adds the dimension of depth so that whatever behind the screen or in front of it is also there. And according to H.G. Wells, time, if anything doesn't have duration, then we don't perceive it. So there are four dimensions to reality, but I compared that, I paralleled that to the four dimensions of being human. And those are the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual. And so four-dimensional parenting is, first of all, realizing that your child has four dimensions to develop in. Then second, learning how to develop your child in each of those dimensions with appropriate activities at each age group. Mm.
Okay, so I would envision something like that is something similar to DBT therapy, where we have four main parts of what DBT therapy is that sort of create the four legs of a chair. And that's what I'm sort of hearing from you, that these four parts is what would be creating a wholesome child. Can you give an example of how that would look different in children, let's say toddlers, to let's say 7-8-year-olds or even 12-year-olds, and how parents can go about the transitioning through these four different dimensions, but through the different age groups as well?
All right. So the first thing you have to understand is how the brain is developing. And there are things that an infant is not capable of. For example, the first, I think it's 7-8 months, they are not even capable of responding to punishment and reward. So to spank a baby, the baby can't connect that with what it just did. So that doesn't work. I mean, all it teaches the baby is that it could get spanked at any time, it doesn't know why, and the world is not a safe place, and perhaps that mommy doesn't like me. So once they reach the age of connecting cause and effect, then that can work, where you can say, good boy, bad boy, terrible thing to say, by the way, bad boy or bad girl, because that labels the child.
Yeah, as opposed to the action.
You're better off to label the action, exactly. And so, however you praise or punish spanking, timeout, you know, whatever your personal belief is, and I'll throw in that I understand most psychologists don't believe in spanking, but so I don't want to get everybody jumping on my back for that, but I mention it because people do it. Anyway, so that comes into effect early, maybe the toddler years. Then what you have to understand about a toddler is that he's got a new range of emotions that he didn't have a year ago, and he doesn't know how to deal with them. And so, frustration. I mean, just, and this is part of what the terrible twos is about. The child feels frustration because he doesn't know what's going on. He's got this rush of hormones through his body he's never experienced before and doesn't really know how to handle it. And so as a parent, your job is to first educate him. Oh, you're angry. Oh, you're happy. And as he feels these things, he has some way to understand.
So creating
them,
an
identifying
awareness would be the first step for all of us parents to be doing whenever our child is going through the stages, because it's brand new to them. It's sort of like putting on a new pair of sneakers and needing to break them in a little bit. When it comes to emotions, it works the same way. Needing to break it in and understand what's happening. Okay, that makes a lot of
sense. Absolutely. Yeah, and so, let me stick with emotion for a little while. And so when you hit the adolescent years, the same thing happens. All of a sudden, you've got a new batch of hormones coming in, and you're getting feelings that you've never experienced before. And it's almost like going through the terrible twos again, except you've got a bigger body. Wow. And
I never looked at that correlation, but you know what? I only have one teenager, but that's predominantly what I work with as a psychotherapist. So I'm going to start using that. I might quote you.
good. And so that's what's happening over and over again. And so you want to be able to teach your child early on. You start with knowing your emotions, then managing your emotions. One of the things I was taught way back in my generation was when you get angry, count to 10. Yes, that gives you time before you blurt out your immediate response. But what it also does is it puts you into the prefrontal cortex, the logical part of your brain. And so instead of you say, oh, you're ugly, my immediate response wells up from the amygdala, I want to attack you. But if I can get into the prefrontal cortex, into my logical part of my brain, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then I might give a more rational response, or at least a rational understanding of what's going on. And so that's part of managing your emotions. Back in the toddler to the preschool years, one of the activities I have is I'm going to be. And so the first game we play is opposites. And so it's Ananya, what is the opposite of happy? What is the opposite of angry?
Happy?
Okay. All right. And so we play that game often enough so you know the answers. Then we start playing a game called I'm Gonna Be. And I say, I'm angry.
Happy.
But I'm gonna be. Exactly. And so we start, we play that game enough so that the child knows the responses. And then one day, what's the matter, Chananya? How do you feel? Oh, I'm
happy.
Angry.
Right.
But I'm going to be. And
Got
you start
it.
To teach the child.
Beautiful.
How to
so
deal
I guess
with
you know,
emotions
what I'm taking out of this is by bringing awareness into what's happening to the body, what's happening in the brain, and in their executive functioning areas. They're able to now be in control. Now, you were talking about angry and happy. I think there's also could be a place for where, okay, I'm angry, but I'm still in control. And therefore, I know how to deal with the situation. So it's not necessarily needing to be happy per se, but needing to be in a place where, yes, I'm angry because my sister just put on my older sister stole my clothes from me, even though it's mine. But at the same time, I'm still able to be in control and say, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. Can I please have it back? So being in control from where we are. And by us as parents, which in my opinion, make the best therapist and better than us therapists. When you have situations where parents are able to bring about that awareness and to show that, hey, you are upset about something. That's okay to be upset. But what are you going to do with it? I think that's what you're saying. And I like the way walking through, I guess, play therapy in some ways and role modeling is what we're looking to do a lot more as parents. How does that change with the language that we would use as a with our 6-7-year-old as opposed to that type of language with a young adult or a teenager?
Okay, so a 6-7-year-old, you want to start the process of self-talk and start filling them like an emotional bank account, start filling them with positive affirmations. And in the very early years, you want them to feel positive about yourself. Oh, you're so smart. Oh, you're so pretty. That sort of thing. Oh, you're strong. Wow. But then maybe 6-7 years old, they start to change a little bit. And now you want to change it from what you are to how hard you try. Okay. Because you can't control the result. Grades at school, you can't control whether you get an A, B, or C, but you can control the amount of effort you put into it. And so things like, oh, man, you really gave that a good shot, or you tried hard. I love the way you practice. Those sort of compliments build what they call grit, okay, which is the ability to overcome failure. And so as they get older, that's what you want them to do is to start
That's
focusing
amazing.
On what they
the phrase
can
that comes
do,
to mind is Angela Duckworth, her book on grit, which is something that I would recommend. And that's even a good idea for us to put in the show notes over here. So I'm writing it down to make sure that that's something that I would recommend to all parents. I might even put it in my, if I had a top 10 list of parenting books, I might even put the word that Angela's book in there, because I think there's so much to be said about effort and what we're doing with whatever the outcome is going to be, but that doesn't change what it is that we're supposed to be doing before and after. So that's a really, really good point. So I want to move on. You know, you talk about the emotional part over here. So there's also a physical and a mental part over here. How does that look through the ages of the child rearing?
Okay. Well, let's take the mental, and that's easy when you have the child at home. Just simple things, vocabulary, teaching them words when they're young and in the toddler years. Then you start with little logical things. What's the opposite of this? What's the synonym? What's a rhyming word? So by the time they get to school, you pretty much farm that out to the school system. They teach knowledge. They teach math and vocabulary. What
critical
you don't
thinking,
necessarily
right.
get in the school system is how to think. And so that's where you have to, yes, exactly. And so you challenge the child. Why do you think that? What would happen next? And my favorite is Socratic questioning. Rather than lecturing the child on what you should do or should be or horribly what your brother does and your sister does, you know, don't compare them.
Can you talk a minute about where
to themselves yesterday
or questions
and how
come from and what the origin of that is? I think it's a beautiful topic, one that I'm a big fan of, but I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about that for a minute for what that is.
All right. Well, been a long time since I studied Greek philosophy, but Socrates was the teacher of Plato. Both famous Greek philosophers, founders of real philosophy, which is the love of wisdom. And in Socratic questioning, you guide a person in the direction you want to do by asking questions. And this is something many people don't know. Salespeople know this. He who asks the questions controls the conversation. Okay? And so by asking the proper questions, you can guide the conversation. So especially with a teenager, you don't want to say, you shouldn't do this. When I was your age, I was doing that. Blah, 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 blah. I was walking 6 miles up to school in the snow both ways, uphill, you know, and all of these horror stories. Why did you do that? Well, what did you think would happen?
Right.
Well, what actually happened? Okay. Why do you think it happened that way instead of the way you thought? know, and you're guiding them.
Beautiful.
Not
beautiful.
Only to an answer, and I think it's something that process, I was, way I wish teachers, of thinking, I wish, and a way
some,
of solving
some of my teachers did it more just to help create the creative blood flow in our brains, just to sort of help us understand why things are happening, of just igniting the thinking that we're talking about, under deeper understanding and creating a really active classroom in the realm of school. I think at home we could do the same thing of, okay, so, you know, you want to, this is what your schedule you want to be like. Yes, I know you're becoming, you're 14 going on 20, and there's a certain amount of freedom that you want, and you want to be able to come and go as you please, eat whatever you please, never clean. Why do you want it that way? What is it about that situation that makes sense to you, and talk about it and talk it out? At least, you know, what I found, I would say, just in my little bit of experience of having my own teenager, but also talking about it in my office, is sometimes people will even say answers. They'll be like, that doesn't make sense. And what that does is it sort of creates like, oh, okay, so maybe, okay, so what else would you want to think? And I think sometimes the hardest part, I think I'm speaking now more as a parent than I am as a therapist, is keeping my mouth shut and realizing that I can't say anything, that because that process through this critical Socratic thinking is putting the child in a place where there is their own responsibility, their own autonomy for whatever decisions that they're trying to make in whatever realm they are throughout the day. So I think, you know, us as parents to know that, bite your tongue and let the process happen. Most of the time, especially if I guess using your example of, you know, we're feeding things throughout their lifetime, that sort of, you know, making this tree stronger. As long as those roots and the soil around the roots have been planted from 2, 3, 4, 8, 10, 12, by the time they're 15, you'll see the thinking itself change and be like, oh no, that doesn't make sense. Like having a dirty room. And my laundry, all I need to do is put it into the basket and bring it to the laundry room, and mom will take care of the rest. So I won't have clean clothes if I don't put stuff in the hamper and bring it to the laundry room. Oh, so I should probably put the stuff in the hamper and I should probably bring it to the laundry room. So it's a simple process, but it will go so much deeper for their own critical thinking, for their understanding of the situation, as opposed to mom keeping saying, just you pick up your clothes and just put it in your hamper and bring it to the room. Like, oh my God, again? That happens again and again. But I think what you're saying, and I love this idea, and I'm so happy that you brought it up, of this Socratic thinking, it makes the situation more understandable for the individual that's talking about it. And therefore, the overall communication and how they're going to go about things in your home are going to be so much easier. So I think it's a really, really good point. And I'm so happy that you brought that up over here. How does that go even further? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Before you ask the next question, just a comment, that our excuse me, our view of ourselves is often not connected to reality. People will say, oh, I'm not a gossip, and then start talking about their neighbors or friends or whatever. Oh, I'm this, I'm that. And then you get confronted with what you don't think you are, and you have to quickly readjust and realize, well, maybe I have been doing that, and I better stop. A very simple example is when I went off to college, and one day my roommate said, God, your tub is filthy. And I looked at it and I went, oh, it is. But I had never, ever had to clean a tub in my life because my mother always did it for me.
Right.
And so all of a sudden now I realize tubs need to be cleaned. And therefore, you know, since then, I cleaned tubs.
Beautiful.
But
beautiful.
Sometimes yeah, I know you need that smack in the
studies
head
to talk about if a person is studying and not able to retain certain information.
Think you are.
Walking away for anywhere, I think the studies show, anywhere from 30 seconds to 15 minutes, and coming back to the same room will give a certain clarity for what it is that you were missing beforehand. Like, oh, okay, so now I understand how this is working. So sometimes having a fresh pair of eyes, and sometimes it can even be your own eyes, can be very, very helpful in how we're going to be retaining information, and getting that slap in the face can also be obviously very, very helpful. So moving on over here, because I think there's so much more information that I feel like, you know, you can share with us, Tim. So we talked about the emotional, and we talked about the mental, and I'm curious about the physical. So that also changes throughout the ages, up and through and past teenage years. How does it start, and what is our responsibility when it comes to toddlers, even younger than that, and going through the ages?
a lot of people don't realize how much the mother's health affects the fetus. So when does care for your child begin? And it's almost at the point of conception, because at that point, as soon as the baby's body develops, the mother's body feeds it. And if the mother, first of all, is smoking, drinking, on drugs, I mean, outside of abortion, that's the worst thing you can do to a fetus. But beyond that, what are you eating? Are you getting enough vitamins to help the fetus grow? All right. Are you, what are you putting on your skin? The different creams that have carcinogens in them. Just cooking when the baby's born, putting the bottle in the microwave, if it's a plastic bottle, can put plastics into the baby. Okay. Certain smoking marijuana, even after birth, can be transferred to the baby through the mother's milk. So you have to be really aware. And I mean, it's a rabbit hole. Once you start looking for things that can damage your body, the list is endless. So you've got to kind of draw the line somewhere of what kind of foods you're going to eat, what kind of foods you're going to put in the house for the child to eat. So when you feed the baby mother's milk, the best choice by nature, if possible. If not, then there are great scientific formulas that you can use if you can't do that. But and then breast milk pumps for the infant. All right, so then when the child starts to eat, naturally has a sweet tooth, but also likes to model behavior. So you put a little bit of broccoli on your plate, you eat it. What's that? That's broccoli. Want some? Okay. You like it? No? Okay. That's for grown-ups. Oh, okay.
Right. Well, he wants to be like his big
tasted
sister.
The broccoli.
So therefore, he'll say
it. Yeah. Didn't have to eat it, but he realizes it's for grown-ups, so he wants to be able to eat it. And then you just keep putting it on. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, little tricks you can do for nutrition. So physically, nutrition, number one. Make the body healthy, especially in the young years. As they get older, if it's not in the house, probably they can't eat it, or at least they can't eat a lot of it. So the parents who buy cookies for the kids and are fat, maybe you shouldn't buy the cookies for the kids and you won't be so fat. I don't know. Don't put it in the house. It makes it a lot harder to eat. And so good nutrition all the way through teenage years becomes very challenging, because then they have their own choices. And then you have to have the questions of, well, how do you feel? What's happening to your skin? Do you think that could be connected to what you're eating? Okay, and back to the Socratic questioning rather than the lectures. All right, so that's good. Exercise. Okay, parents want to use electronic devices as a babysitter. Here's the phone. Let me go do what I want to do. Here's a tablet. Okay. The best research we have, zero, absolutely no screen time for the first 18 months. Then an hour a day guided screen time. Don't just give them the pad and let them play. What's going on? Is that a doggy? What does the doggy say?
Yeah.
Is that a kitty cat?
That's a really good point. I know
interaction, that human interaction.
A book by Adam Alter,
that's
Irresistible,
how the brain develops.
Where he talks about
not by pushing buttons
the
and sliding across the screen.
All right, electronic use. And he brings a study in there talking about when a parent will sit there and watch with their child and talk about the things and sort of pause and say, hey, you know, do you see how that child grabbed from the other one? Is that something that we do? Or do you see how they returned a lost object that you know, that wasn't theirs, or how nice they were, or how, you know, that neat they were, or how they were eating nicely? And that information, while you're sitting there with your child, instead of it being a babysitting service, turns into a real long-term retention of the information that they're sitting with in that time together with mom or dad. And it becomes a bonding experience and a lifelong learning experience as well.
Absolutely. And television, just understand that any TV show that has commercials is designed to get your kids to eat sugar. It is sponsored. And so, no, you know, any show that has commercials, they're going to tell your kid, you need sugar. You need this cereal. And it makes them somehow feel inadequate if they don't have it. So if you're going to watch TV, it's better to get a paid service with no commercials. But again, be there with the child.
Beautiful.
Don't let the news so on with all that violence in the background.
I guess you could say more
you're
screen
dinner
time
and the kid's watching the news, or you're
awake.
Watching the
and
news
I
and
say
the kid
more
hears
time
it.
Away from under the direct hands of mom and dad. What would you recommend the physical education should be from the parent's point of view?
First of all, modeling, whatever you enjoy, go bike riding together. Very simple. Go for walks together, go to the park, look at nature. If you've got water, swim, canoe, boating of any sort, skiing in the winter, sledding. Just get out and have fun and appreciate what happened and what happens outside and off the screen. This is totally unscientific. But when I was a baby, my father used to take my legs and just move them up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, and laugh about it. And then when I turned 16, I loved to run. Was there a connection to that scientifically?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm sure there is a correlation. And you know, I don't think all correlations need to have science behind
there to
it.
Lose
because I think correlations
something like that,
can be from different from
even
every
in the
individual,
infant, a
from
joy
every
of
sibling,
movement.
From twins. The correlation for how you might connect to something could be very different. And I think the same way, let's say, in the trauma world, they talk about how things can affect you differently for being in the same bar. Bessel van der Kolk talks about this in his book, Body Keeps the Score, when you have twins that were in car accidents and the trauma parts of the brain were affected differently from every person, even twins. I think when it comes to our correlations from moving our legs to the types of foods that we eat to the things that we watch can have a different impact on every single person. But I think it's a great idea. And I think every parent has to look and find those things that work for them, for that child. And it's we're not going to bat 1,000. You know, keep in mind that baseball players make the Hall of Fame are usually batting about 300, which is only 30% of the time getting a hit. And when it comes to doing the things that we need to do as parents, I think it works the same way sometimes. We're not going to find their favorite food that's healthy, not the chicken nuggets. We're not going to find those things right away. We're not going to find that those activities that are oh, you know what? I like this, so therefore they're going to like this. No, that's not necessarily true either. But looking, searching, finding those things that are going to be long-lasting or create a healthy experience to the running or to some other outdoor activity, I think that's what our job is as parents physically. And that doesn't change from 2 to 12 to 22. And showing our support, but yet also saying, okay, how do you want to go about this? Using the Socratic thinking, I think is such a vital, vital part to how what our job is as parents in general. I want to move on to the last part over here. And in some ways, yeah. Beautiful.
But one more comment, if I may, before the last question. And that is, the child is not there to relive your life as you had wanted to. So if you wanted to be a major league baseball player and threw out your shoulder in high school, and now it's your big chance to get your son into the major leagues, and your son may not, first of all, have the same talent you had, but second of all, even if he has the talent, just may not like baseball. But maybe he likes lacrosse, or maybe he likes ballet.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank
but
you so much for saying
that. Whatever it is.
I should have said that a lot earlier. And
let him
I wish I was said almost every single podcast that I do, because I think that's such an important part of parenting. We are not here to live vicariously through our children.
If you had
and
the
that
chance
applies
to do it over.
To every single parent, whether it's natural, adopted, or surrogate, doesn't make a difference. Every single child of ours has a right for them to be themselves. And it's our job to help them be the best version of themselves. So thank you for saying that over here. And I know there's a...
Yeah. And if I may say vicariously, in my understanding of the word, I don't think it's bad to live vicariously through your children if you take joy in their accomplishments and take joy in their, in whatever it is they do. Not, you know, I understand what you're saying and what I'm saying.
And take credit. 100%.
Because
I think there are so many things that we go through. Like,
you know, if they're living their life and enjoying it,
when it comes to parenting, there's so much self-doubt. Like, did I do the right thing?
It should make you feel fantastic.
I can't believe I did that. So when we have those situations where things are going well and the kid finds that sport or that recreational activity that they like, that may not be my cup of tea, but be something that they like, enjoy the heck out of it and say, hey, so happy for you. And I think that's exactly what you know, we're talking about. Yeah. So I think we're on the same page, and thank you for, you know, for changing the wording there. Cause I think you're right on that sense over here. I know there's so much more on these first three topics that we've talked about. But I really want to move on to this last one. And in some ways, the one that I'm both personally and professionally, when I say personally, meaning for myself and personally as a parent, and then also professionally, when we talk about the spiritual part of parenting and what that looks like and how that's something we are, when a child is 2-3 years old, how we're going to start implementing, probably even earlier than 2-3 years old, but then also taking that through the young adult and teenage years and through those questioning years of life, like what is life of a young adult and what is the role of a parent in that?
All right. And so spirituality is one of the four dimensions I believe we have. I believe we are spiritual beings having a physical, mental, emotional experience. And that when the body dies, the spirit somehow lives on. I haven't been there. I don't know exactly how it works, but that's the realm of spirituality. If you reject that completely, let me keep you in the conversation and talk about morality. Even if you are a lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell, hopefully you still believe in morality, the difference between right and wrong. And so there has been scientific research, psychological research on morality. That's a basis of a lot of what I will say. But in my opinion, the spiritual realm is not subject to the rules of science. The emotional world is not subject to the world of science. How do you explain love? You cannot scientifically explain love. They're different dimensions of being. So emotional rules and emotional ways of reacting are not logical ways of reacting. Spiritual rules are based on belief, not on fact. And so that's how I will approach it as we discuss this, but I will also try to add some logic, some morality to it. And so how do you develop that? Again, starting before the baby's born. If you go to church, when you go to church, the baby goes to church or mosque or temple, whatever your religion is. If you meditate, the baby will be there while you meditate. Okay? You can sing to the baby some songs. You can read scriptures aloud, especially when the baby's born. Some of the reading you do can be scriptural. It can be the actual scriptures. It can be moral books where even if it's a cat and a dog and they do the right thing and you read that story to the child, and this is maybe when they're a year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, depending on your dedication.
Is there a book out there that you would recommend
for
parents to be giving over to children in this realm
from, let's say,
the 2 to 10 year old range? Maybe there's a different book from, let's say, from 10 to 15 or 15 to 20.
Where there's a morality to it, where somebody does.
Okay.
No. I don't have expertise, so no, I don't offer anything. All right. So, but again, not a book, but something people can relate to, Star Wars. Most everybody's seen the movie. Okay. It doesn't necessarily become a morality tale, but you can find moral lessons in the story. So just about any story, if you read it with the child, you can ask the questions. Why did this happen? Why do you think he did it? What do you think? And depending on the age, the early years, they're not ready for what was the kitty cat thinking. Okay, up to, I believe it's 3, they cannot imagine a different worldview than their own. If you offer a child a piece of candy and a piece of broccoli, and you say, Daddy likes broccoli, you like candy, what would you like to give Daddy? The early child, 2 and 3 year old, will say, here, Daddy, take the candy. At about 3, maybe 4, they start to understand the other person has different desires, and they'll say, give Daddy the broccoli. Okay. And so that's when you can start saying, what does the other person think? What does the other person want? That's when, oh, maybe about 5, the child starts to understand that it's not about me. It's about the other person and how they feel. And so that's when you can start saying, you hurt mommy's feelings. 2-year-old doesn't understand that. 5-year-old will. Okay. Up to that age, you're probably dealing with cause and effect. And that's where a timeout, a loud voice, sometimes just a look, depending on how sensitive the child is, teaches them that you get this bad result when you do that, or you get this good result when you do this. And of course, children respond to attention. So if they get a lot of attention for being bad, it reinforces them being bad. So in my opinion, whenever the child does something wrong, the negative feedback, a look, a voice, a timeout, if you believe in spanking up to a certain age, I'd say no more than 4, because that's when they start understanding what you're telling them. Before that, it's hard to understand it. So sometimes, in my opinion, a light slap might accomplish a lot more than 2 minutes of explanation that they don't understand. But again, choice. The negative response, and then finish it with a hug. I love you. Now let's practice the good thing to do and give them a lot of attention for doing the good thing. Take away the attention on the bad, give attention on the good. That's going to follow right through the teenage years. The methods will change, but the attention is really what's important.
And, and children, that's what they're looking for.
Even through the teenage years,
exactly. They're looking for that attention.
For attention.
And all those behaviors are attention-seeking behaviors.
Have you heard of the teenager who goes out, steals cars, gets in trouble just to get attention from the parent who doesn't pay attention to them? Cut all that out. Give the attention early. Absolutely. All right. And so somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 7 years old, they begin to understand equal distribution. Okay. So if you get a new pair of shoes, your sister should get a new pair of shoes. Okay. That's equal distribution. And to an early child, the reason Sally got an A on the paper and I got a B on the paper is because the teacher likes Sally better. They don't understand the cause and effect. Once they start understanding cause and effect, then they realize that Sally studied more than me. Sally drew a better picture than me. Okay. But until they understand cause and effect, at least 5 years old, they don't see that. They can't learn from it. All right. So we go on to about 7 years old. And this is when a lot of religions have a ceremony because the child at 7 makes a big moral jump. And they start understanding distribution according to merit. So if we have one pair of shoes, we have enough money to buy one pair of shoes. We can't buy shoes for everybody. Who should get the shoes? Your sister has holes in her shoes. You don't have holes in your shoes. What do you think? Well, my sister should get the shoes. Distribution according to merit. And they start taking into account what other people think. They start worrying about what their friends think. Okay. Somewhere around 10, they have developed a morality of cooperation.
Sacrifice of yourself.
And so this is where the social good becomes more important. What does everybody think of me? what's good for the group. And if this is the age where you could conceivably sacrifice yourself, not necessarily death, but maybe do a little extra, yes, sacrifice of yourself. Thank you. Do a little extra work for the sake of the group, even if it hurts you or bothers you to do that extra work. And so that's the morality of cooperation. And then somewhere, hopefully in the early teen years,
I love it. They start to look at universal principles. There's a lot of
what's right and what's wrong.
Parents
and you do it
about doing well over
not
here.
Because
I,
of what
I want to go back to one thing you were talking about Star Wars. So
not because
I remember,
of whether you'll get caught
to
or
a,
not.
Interview from
but because
George
it's
Lucas,
right
talked
thing.
About one of his inspirations being Joseph Campbell, who was famous for his book A Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is very much a philosophy and moralistic based book, and the whole story of Star Wars in itself is a moral based story, even for going back from the first ones up until the more recent ones. And I think that the concept of the story being there, whether a person might find it in Star Wars for whoever that might be, or whether it might be whatever religious book or some other spiritual or ethical book, finding that story that works, that a child is able to resonate with, I think it goes such a long way for how they're going to be taught and how they're going to learn. And I think it's important to realize it's like planting a seed. And when you plant a seed, there's a lot of work that needs to be done and a lot of pre-work that needs to be done in order for that seed to grow. And I have yet to meet a seed that grows overnight, unless it's Jack and the Beanstalk. But besides for that, nothing grows overnight. And I think that's an important thing for us as parents to be constantly reminded of, is that no matter what seed we're trying to plant, whether it's across these four different dimensions, and I think especially when it comes to spirituality and religion and ethics, is that we plant a seed, but we have to let it grow. We have to let it be. And it's important for us to realize that just because I do something a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that my child is going to do something the same exact way. And I think that's where that, you know, using the right language for using the word vicariously comes into play, and realizing that I have to do things what is best for my child. Yes, it may be a little bit different from me, but I could still vicariously live through their appreciation to life and how they're living a fulfilled life, which obviously will look different in every single child, in every single household. And it's not necessarily going to be just because people have the same last name that they're all going to be exactly the same. If anything, I might even say that if you have multiple children and they all look exactly the same, something looks a little bit off, that there's something not the way it's supposed to be. Now, it doesn't mean that they might not have the same beliefs, or they might not have, you know, the same moral ethics. But I think good parenting is, in general, when every child is the best version of themselves and not necessarily a cookie cutter, you know, same last name John Smith as everyone else that's in the house. My last question for you over here, as there's so much more for us to be talking about, Tim, but through these four dimensions, there could be a lot of, let's call it, outside influences that come up, whether it's a school system, whether it's a social system, or a community system that might be a little bit different than what I am trying to teach my child. And I think one of the things that I picked up from this talk today is that a lot of parenting has to do with parents, not the outside sources, not the school system, not what the world says. It's about what I want to be doing in my house and doing it properly. Unfortunately, there is no actual manual, and that's why it takes a lot of work. But when it comes to the outside sources, which anyone that's not living under a rock is living in a world where there are other people around that might be a little bit different, what would you say to parents that might experience a child that they're dealing with that's there, that they're trying to have the tree grow the way they want it to grow, but yet there are these outside sources that are coming to sort of battle with that?
All right. So you can, first of all, you have to accept that there are things you can control and things you can't control. Okay. And know the difference. All right. Unfortunately, it takes a village to raise a child, and the new village is the internet. But that is something you can control. And so as I said earlier, absolutely no screen time for the first 18 months, an hour a day for the early years. Do not let them on social media until at least they're allowed to be on social media by the social media rules. Facebook says you can't be a member till you're 13. Not my rule. Can't do it. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, those are steps you can take. You can control the phone. First of all, why does a five-year-old need a phone? But at some point, yes, they need a phone, if only for safety reasons, so that they can call home. But at the early years, you put all kinds of controls on that device. You set limits, how much time they can spend there, just like you set limits on who their friends can be. Before you have to set limits, you choose the friends they can be. You bring them to a soccer club or a martial arts class or a gymnastics class, someplace that holds the same values you do. You bring them to whatever Sunday school amounts to in your religion, where they meet other children and have friends who have the same beliefs you do. You choose your play dates with which parents, children you want your kids to grow up with. And so those are a lot of things you can control. By the time they're teenagers, you have to pretty much have set the boundaries or set the critical thinking. That's one of the things that happens in the spiritual realm is they start questioning everything. And if you don't allow the questioning, that's a can of worms. Where, okay, you know, the Bible says this and you got to believe it. Why do I have to believe it? Okay, if I can't answer that question, let the priest, let the rabbi answer that question. But there has to be some ground once they start thinking that way, something to hang on to. And so an example I like to give is if you teach your daughter to do what she's told. By the time she's 15 and she has a boyfriend and the boyfriend said, hey, I'm your boyfriend, you're supposed to have sex with me, what's she going to do? Okay. If you teach your daughter to think about everything she's told, all right, let's watch this commercial. What are they trying to get you to do? What's their agenda? All right, let's watch Fox News for 5 minutes. What's their agenda?
Right.
Now let's go over to MSNBC and, watch that.
Two things that came to mind as you're talking about that.
What's their agenda?
When you talk about, there are going to be outside forces that are going to impact
just because it's on the internet
through these four dimensions or any other theory.
And so you need to think about it. And then when the boyfriend says, I think you're supposed to have sex with me,
just acknowledging the fact that there are outside forces and there's going to be pushback and letting children know that, hey, there's going to be pushback on this and that's okay. And, you know, we want it to be something that we are able to work with and not have it to be a battle, and to understand that, yeah, there's going to be people that are not going to see it this way. I think it goes a very, very long way of understanding that this it's a constant work or battle, however you want to look at it, and embracing that. And I think the second part is also telling children, we're not going to bat 1,000, like we were saying before. And there are going to be times and situations where we're not going to do as well as we would have liked. And that's okay. That's fine. That's part of doing things properly. And I think that goes a very long way when that message, together with these four dimensions, which I think are absolutely phenomenal pillars or legs of a chair that I think are so important for our child rearing over here, as we're sort of wrapping up things over here, which this has been an absolute amazing, and hopefully one day we'll have a follow-up on the amazing other topics that, you know, we can talk about, both within that this realm of the four horsemen or when some of the other topics. But I want to end off with a few little rapid questions over here. If you can think of a book, and I know we've mentioned a few books today, but if you could think of a book that you would recommend where people can get more information besides for your own, which we are going to post a link to, is there a book that you would recommend where parents can get more information on how to better the home and their parental situation?
And unfortunately, no.
Was there a researcher out there that you gained a lot of information from?
Because it's got the research, it's got the activities, it's got theory, it's got practice. But beyond that, no.
B.F. Skinner?
I did years of research and try to compile it. And so picking one, no. Sorry.
PSA.
Again, no, I had to go through all the ages. I take that back. Skinner. Skinner, no. No. I mean, but Piaget. Piaget's research was the basis for what I did as far as what's happening to the brain, what they're capable of at each age. And then Kohlberg
or is the one who did the research on morality. Either as a parent or
and
or
so
as
I rely heavily on them.
You don't but mind sharing
also do
it,
you know, lean a lot on a CBT and the kind of things where you don't talk about it for years. You do something that will change you now.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
I don't know about how short. One of my favorite stories is my father. He always said, you tell me the truth, I'm your best ally. You lie to me, I'm your worst enemy. All right. And so my little brother was still in elementary school, and they were doing wedgies. And wedgies is where you pull the back of somebody's underwear up into their butt. And, you know, it's not a very nice thing to do. And he was in a Catholic school, and the nuns called home and said, we need you to come in here and talk to us. Your child is misbehaving. And my father said, well, why can't you handle it? And they said, well, we think it involves insertion. Okay. So now my dad is upset. He comes. I'm playing basketball. My brother's in the stands. He calls him out of the stands, drags him home, says, what's a wedgie? And he explains
it. Wow, I love that story. Oh my gosh. So many memories just popped into my brain just when you said that word wedgie. But
not so calmly explains to them.
That's a great story. My last question for you over here. And again, it's an absolute pleasure.
Or sexualizing.
I really learned a lot from this. If you can think of one mundane, everyday superpower that you would have to help with your parenting skills, what would that be?
Oh, the superpower would be to control the way other people think. There was a book called The Mule, and
yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Where can people find you and hear more about you?
Slowly learning to rule the universe. And so that would be a wonderful superpower to keep people from doing bad things, to get into Vladimir Putin's brain and get him to call off this war. You know, what an amazing superpower that would be. All right, so the website for my book is 4D-2D.com, and that's D as in dimension, the number 4, D as in dimension, dash, can't forget the dash, 2D.com. If you forget the dash, you end up in China, not where you want to be. So 4D-2D.com, that's where I explain the book and how useful it is. There's a press. If you look on the different pages, there's a press release or a press page that has more about me.
Beautiful. And we will have links to this video will soon be posted in the show notes. Again, Tim, thank you so much.
So that's where you can find out about it. Or, of course, you can go to Amazon and just search for Raising Four-Dimensional Children. That should be enough to get you to the book. It's called Raising Four-Dimensional Children in a two-dimensional world, which is where we started getting them off the screen and into the real world. Thank you for teaching me as well.
Hey again. I hope you were able to learn as much as I did today. Thank you so much for staying to the end and listening to the entire interview. Please feel free to leave a comment wherever you listen to this podcast. All comments will be read weekly, and we appreciate all feedback and ideas. If you have an idea for a guest or a specific topic, please feel free to share. Additionally, you can contact us at parentingiseasypodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's parentingiseasypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for joining today. And remember, parenting is a journey. Don't forget to enjoy it. The goal is to be a little better today than yesterday, and hopefully better tomorrow than we were today.